This podcast is part of the Gonna Geek Network. The opinion expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gonna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GonnaGeek.com and get ready because geekiness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Night has fallen on Arthouse Legends and something sinister lurks in the shadows. Three geeks and their guests will look on the critically acclaimed terrors of cinema and judge their work. Settle your spine and watch your step as you trespass into
the Art House of Horror.
Welcome to the podcast that runs a tight ship, even if that ship is a U-boat. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and along with me are...
This is Kent, and I was just talking with my puppy here about what a great actor the dog in this movie is. Just amazing. Superb. And mind you, that dogs like that are actually great pets. And I'm anti-defamation for that.
Yeah, you tell that dog that. You don't want him getting any ideas.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Chris, and these stupid fucking words are my last.
In this episode, we're discussing Green Room, starring Anton Yelchin, Imogen Poots, Alia Shawkat, Joe Cole, Callum Turner, Mark Webber, Macon Blair, and Patrick Stewart, directed by Jeremy Saulnier. Gentlemen, we have come to the end of the Art House of Horror for 2017, and we're ending on a pretty brutal note, and this has been a pretty brutal season, hasn't it?
Well, yes, this is brutal and actually more graphic, surprisingly, than the other movies.
I mean, the flesh-eating zombies, the clowns that knock people's heads off and eat people with shadow puppets, and a particular chainsaw enthusiast.
And yet this movie has more blood in it than I think all of those combined.
I have to say, when it comes to Green Room, there was a bunch of reasons why I wanted to do this particular movie. One of which is the fact that I'm getting really sick and tired of Jeremy Saulnier not getting the attention that he deserves. I saw his kind of big breakout, which was a movie called Blue Ruin, about 3 years ago. And after seeing that movie, I was going to go see anything that he was going to do next. And then, of course, when I find out that he's working with an actor that I've literally been watching since he was a child, which is Anton Yelchin, which we'll be talking about a little bit later, I knew that I was really going to go see this. In fact, I went opening night for the screening that it was here in Houston. But out of curiosity, how were you made aware of this movie? And have you seen any of Saulnier's work prior to doing this episode?
I think you told me about this movie originally.
Oh, I advertised this heavily after seeing it about 2 years ago, just before Anton Yelchin's unfortunate accident. But I was on record as being a huge fan of this movie when it came out. But have you seen A Blue Ruin, or perhaps his first film? Which I think would probably be right more up your alley than Blue Ruin, if you're aware of that movie. It was called Murder Party.
Okay.
Guess not.
So I didn't realize this was part of a trilogy until I went looking at...
The supplemental?
Yeah. Looked at the Captain's Log supplemental. We have to do at least one Stuart as Captain Picard joke.
Oh, don't worry. I have a feeling we're going to have a few Captain Picard jokes here, especially when we get to the end of the film. But yeah. What about you, Chris? How aware or were you of Jeremy Saulnier's work prior to this episode?
I have not seen Murder Party, but I did see Blue Ruin, and I went to the screening for Green Room. So, I mean, and I loved it when I saw it then, but... Yeah.
Now, I guess I should also kind of put it out there that Green Room made my great films of 2015. So I probably am coming into this particular screening pretty biased. As I've also mentioned before, I'm a huge fan of Blue Ruin, and that would have been on my top 10 list that year if I'd seen it when it actually had come out. I hit it when it was on Netflix. But No, this is a director that I'm, even to this day, I'm looking forward to with his next film. And, of course, nothing has shown up yet. So when he does announce his next work, I'm going to be as excited as other filmmakers that I follow.
He does have something coming out next year, I think, according to IMDb.
I haven't seen anything yet, but I'll wait until I see like a trailer, especially when it comes to more indie directors. You don't really know what they're doing until they kind of show something. And I have a feeling it's going to be one of those that's going to hit either Sundance or Cannes. Just kind of like how Blue Ruin hit Cannes, and it kind of made a big splash there, and then it, you know, became the thing that it is. So it's one of those things that I'll be waiting until I see something. Just until that point, you know, I'll just be anxious to see what he does next. But let's go ahead and let's talk about this movie, because quite honestly, there is quite a bit to this movie. Now, I have to admit, though, that when I saw one trailer for this movie prior to seeing it, and just because I couldn't understand what the trailer was saying about what this movie was, I kind of decided that I was just not going to go in with any more knowledge than what I saw with that one trailer. I was kind of surprised that this movie was kind of about punk rock a little bit. I knew that Green Room kind of was insinuating that this was some sort of showbiz thing. Obviously, they're rockers. But how familiar are you with the punk rock scene? What do you make of kind of the background here? And I guess I'll start off with you, Chris. Do you have any kind of familiarity with punk rock?
Not really. Not the bands they mention, I guess. Because I'm more, like, modern, I guess. More alternative than punk, I guess. So.
Yeah. What about you, Kent? Are you a former metalhead?
I was metalhead adjacent. Not quite so much punk adjacent, since there is a difference.
Ah.
I did go to Warped Tour this year.
Oh, nice.
But that's... It's not quite as punk, but there were punks there, so, yeah.
Well, the fact that I'm mistaken punk and metal just shows how familiar I am with the whole scene, but...
They are very removed from, you know, the modern top 40, so... Mm-hmm. And they're both, you know, heavier,
mm-hmm.
so... Mm-hmm. And don't give a damn. Yeah!
But there is a...
Are you punk enough?
But the other element to this particular movie that was kind of insinuated in the trailer, but kind of really didn't kind of come into focus until actually watching the movie, but this film is dealing with something that is kind of more, I don't want to say mainstream, but more visibly present in the current events. We're dealing with the alt-right and neo-Nazis as kind of the villain of this movie. How do you feel about this kind of being a punk rock versus Nazi type scenario?
As far as punk goes, it doesn't strike me as much punk as much as just wrong place, wrong time.
They were there because they were invited to do a gig at this bar in the middle of the woods, which
nowhere.
Is never a good sign. But hey, a gig is a gig, right? But it turns out that it's this neo-Nazi bar. I love how they kind of set it up as alt-right. You know, this is alt-rightish type of thinking, type of philosophy. Yet once you go in, there's a lot of Nazi insignia, some swastikas, some SS, and definitely white supremacy all over the walls. Right? It's pretty Nazi. Can we put it that way?
Yeah.
Just a little bit, you know. But what about you, Chris? What do you kind of take of the punk rock versus Nazi vibe that this movie's going for?
I'm not political to begin with, so I didn't really look at it like that. I mean, they could have put any two groups together, and I'd have been like, oh, all right, cool, I'll go with it, you know, whatever. So I mean. I don't know, it didn't really faze me one way or the other.
All right. Well, I don't know. To me, when it comes to this type of movie, I did see an interview where Sonia kind of mentioned that this isn't a political type movie, that he obviously when he was making this, the alt-right really didn't kind of come to prominence. It's just that obviously with it being 2015 when this movie was released, that a certain political movement was kind of coming into attention because of the election that was kind of coming to a head around that particular point, or was starting to rear its head because it had been another year before the election itself. But yeah, this is kind of, you know, kind of a thing where this just kind of collided with, you know, the events that were happening. But at the same time, though, I think it's also kind of interesting that punk rock has always been kind of an independent type of music, right? It's kind of breaking against the normal rules of musical expression. It's very angry. It's very kind of frenetic, right? The kind of thing that if you were to talk about, you know, kind of neo-Nazis, that in a way you would kind of see neo-Nazis kind of taking that type of expression, right? In fact, you know, one of the things that especially when you see neo-Nazis, that they do have kind of a punkish type of mentality in themselves. Do you kind of get that?
Yeah.
But I guess before we actually get into the whole punk versus neo-Nazi, let's talk about our main protagonist right quick, our band. They are called Ain't Right. Which, again, considering that the movie does call it alt-right as a thing, I'm wondering if that's meant to kind of be a dig, right? That you know, this ain't right. These aren't right-leaning people. You know, that this is, you know, they're not exactly left. They're not political, but they're against the forces that we will be seeing later on, right?
I don't know if in universe that's where they came up with the band name, because Ain't Right could easily also be those kids ain't right.
Well, I think that you can take concept, it kind of any way, but in a way, considering that the movie does call out when they're talking to the reporter, the reporter who gets them the gig says that they are alt-right, and they kind of still bring up alt-right, you know, in the earlier part of the film, right? This is a universe that does have alt-right as a thing, you know. So I guess for me, though, I want to say that Ain't Right. I mean, ain't is obviously not a very good use of, you know, diction. But, you know, I don't think that punk rockers really care about formalities and punctuation or, you know, correct grammar usage. Although it would be awesome if we did have grammar Nazi punk rockers. I would say right there, that would be awesome in itself, right?
No, correct grammar is not punk.
Oh, boy.
Being a grammar Nazi is not punk.
Oh.
Even though having ironic grammar Nazis would have...
Okay, so...
But in that instance, probably not.
Should be grammar Nazis versus real Nazis, right? Right? Just saying. We could have that. All right, fine. But what do you take of all this, Chris? Do you kind of see the juxtaposition between the band's name and kind of what they'll be facing later on?
Kind of. It seems like a bit of a stretch to me, though, I guess.
All right, but let's talk about the band members themselves. So we have three guys and a girl in this band. We have... I want to say it's Reese that's the front man. We have Callum Turner, who is, I want to say, the bass. Tiger, who's the bass. Anton Yelchin is lead guitar, and Sam is, are, you know, the token girl in the band.
Token,
she's the drummer, isn't? Am I not right?
No, the dude was the drummer, and she was a bass.
I'm sorry. So I got that wrong. So Tiger was the drummer, and Sam was the bass. Sorry, I can't believe I got that wrong. Yeah, you're right. She was bass.
Yeah.
So I also love the fact that when we open up to this film, we see that they had crashed into a cornfield. What did you think of this opening? You know, if you've never seen anything about this movie prior to seeing this movie, what did you make of that?
I thought they were just hiding out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But What do you take of them kind of, you know, waking up and they're pissed off at one another about, you know, having the car running, you know, they're out, pretty much out of gas. They, you know, they're in the middle of this cornfield. God knows what'll happen if a farmer decides to, you know, confront them over this. What do you take of that?
I'm surprised they didn't die of carbon monoxide poisoning.
Well, no, I mean it's not like they're they're in a place where the carbon monoxide would be in the van itself. But what do you? But I guess the thing is kind of what is that set up about this group? You know, considering what we see in the first 5 minutes of their life. You know, the first 5 minutes sets up what these characters are, right?
Yeah.
So, and especially when with Saulnier, because what I absolutely love about his work, he never outright tells you what you need to know. He will kind of come at it from a scant. So, like with Blue Ruin, he will go out of his way to have you asking questions. Okay, so what's happening? Where do we stand with these characters? Why are they going here? And he doesn't outright come out and say what it is. He'll just kind of, you have to kind of grasp onto details. So, like, the fact that they crashed into this cornfield and the way that they crashed, you know, so basically we know that they had been, you know, they've been driving for a long period of time. They got tired and, you know, the driver got tired and fell asleep behind the wheel, right? So, when we get to the whole gas thing, they take a bicycle, they go to the closest place where there are cars, and what do?
Siphon gas.
Yeah. And the fact that they say, okay, is this a roller rink or an ice hockey rink? Why? Because hockey players will kick your ass. So what does that imply about what these characters, about what the knowledge that they have about what they're about to do?
Been doing it a long time.
Yeah.
And we get all that information in 5 minutes without them outright coming out and saying what it is. We see the bumper stickers on the car, which are all of what?
I don't remember the bumper stickers.
Well, the bumper stickers are all bands. They're all over the place. You have band names all on these bumper stickers that are all over the car. So that tells us that they're heavy into music. We see the inside. We see that there's equipment there. So basically, we already kind of have an indication as to who these characters are within 5 minutes, and they don't outright and say, "Okay, we're a band and we're going to a gig," or that we're going in this particular instance to an interview, right?
Yeah.
If I'm incorrect, please let me know.
Well, it's interview and also sounds like he was. The interviewer was setting up some mini show and interviewing people for it, and then he did something, that got him pretty much banned from ever hosting any bands.
What it was is that he had set up a gig, or that there was going to be some sort of that he has set up a gig for them, and unfortunately because of another gig that he had set up that turned really nasty, they couldn't perform because he had lost that venue. Because of the piss, the puke, and the shit that had been left in that venue, so he set up a last minute gig, which I have to admit was kind of funny, right? Come on, the idea of them playing at a Tex-Mex restaurant, especially what I'm going to assume is the Northwest, right? We're talking about Washington, or Oregon, right?
But where was this supposed to be? Because I thought they made a mention about the East Coast during it.
It looks very West Coast. And another reason why I kind of think it's the West Coast is because one thing I do know, and I guess this is also kind of historical, but Washington and Oregon are deep into metal and into punk.
Right.
You know,
But that looked like a cornfield.
Well, they say they traveled 90 miles. So if that's the case, then it could have been that they've been in Idaho or Utah, and there might be corn or maize or some variation that are in those particular states, right?
Okay, I was thinking more Midwest feel, like maybe they were in Virginia or something, but yeah.
Well, another interesting indication about this is the fact that we never see sunshine And one thing that...
Yeah, it is dreary.
Yeah. Now, that could have definitely been a stylistic approach, but if you kind of take it as, you know, that there's a lot of trees, and we're talking about a lot of, coniferous trees, you got the sense that this is a very, that this is on the kind of northwestern side of the country. Or what do you think, Chris? Is there a good indication here, or is it kind of meant to be anywhere?
I'm not sure. I didn't pick up on any like certain locations either time I watched it. So
yeah. Well, there's no bumper. There's no, you know, no state that said it could be Midwest. It's just are there trees like that in say Michigan or
yeah.
Minnesota?
There's nice little forested areas.
Yeah, but with those types of trees?
I didn't look too closely at the trees. Ah. They're not palm trees, so I mean, I don't.
We're not talking about California, though. You know, we're talking up in the northern part, but.
I mean, if you're going to see trees above frost line, you're going to pretty much see the same species everywhere.
Yeah, you got a point there.
So, especially in North America, it's still pretty evenly spaced, so. What was I going to say? Consistent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
But I think it's very, but so the fact that they're kind of put in the situation where they're hundreds of miles away from home, they have, what, $16 to their name. And, you know, and that this is the point where they have the ability to take another gig that'll at least get them home. Right. Mm-hmm. And of course we find out that this is a pretty dangerous type of club. You know, that, it definitely has clientele that are not of the nice variety, right?
Well, the minute they get told, hey guys, it's a Nazi club.
No, he doesn't say Nazi. He just says that it's an alt-right, you know, don't talk about politics and to focus on your early work, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
So, you know, they never come out and say that it's a Nazi bar. It's only when we actually get into the bar itself and we see, we see the Nazi insignia that we realize kind of what we are. And in a way, the fact that he used the term alt-right, and I don't want to keep harping on this, but it seemed like they kind of understood a little bit of what they were getting into, right?
Yeah.
But
there's a paycheck involved, so...
But yeah,
but right off...
But this does
first
get us
song
to
selection
our...
is not a good one.
That's true. But this gets us to our destination. This is where we're going to be for the rest of the film. So what do we think about this bar? The kind of the way that it's set up, the way that it's kind of its location, the geography. Because as everyone seems to know by now, I love me some geography in a movie. So what do y'all take of this? Do you kind of get a sense of where you are, of where everything kind of stands with one another, considering that we have a series of shots that gets us from the outside to the green room itself?
It does do a good job of guiding how relatively small that club is. I mean, good efficient use of space, but really just club room, hallway, and then green room.
So. But also another thing that you that should be interesting about this particular walkthrough is that the film also uses this a chance to tell us what kind of building this is and kind of what kind of club it is, because we do focus in on, you know, the graffiti in this bar. You know, we see the things that are written on the walls. We see those stickers that are plastered all over the place. It focuses on that. It makes sure that we see the little insignias, the little the kind of not just the fact that this shit is all over the place, but the fact that it seems to be condoned by the establishment, right? You know, it's not like we're seeing this stuff getting wiped off. You know, this stuff is in plain sight and, you know, it stands unmolested. You kind of see that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also it feels like the whole building's kind of bunkerish. Only really one door we can see. Hardly any windows.
Well, it is a club. You know, it's...
Yeah, but no back door for, like, deliveries or emergency exits.
Well, it is also kind of a deep woods club. It's not as though that they're having to worry about deliveries in the middle of a set, right? I mean, for all we know, this started out about, what, they go on at 2 o'clock. So this is in the afternoon. that their set starts, right? So you would assume that all the deliveries would be made in the morning. You know, there's not going to be any kind of midday delivery that's going to be interfered with. But and on top of that, if you're in a punk bar with the amps as loud and as heavy as they are, do you really want to have windows in that place?
No.
I'm telling you right now, they would be paying more in glass than, you know, on the windows than they would in the of all the, you know, all the glasses that would be shattered, you know, by rowdy patrons. In fact, I wouldn't be surprised that they were using plastic just because, you know, save themselves some money, right? Mm-hmm. But another little detail that I absolutely love about this movie is that the main office isn't even in the fucking club. There's a little...
Oh, no, it's easier that way.
Huh?
Yeah. It's easier to, you know, hide the money. Yeah, fix the books. And...
I don't think they're actually worried about getting robbed. You get the sense that you even think about trying to rob this place. You know, you better call and apologize for it.
Yeah.
You know, you get the sense that this is a very orderly, as rowdy and as crazy as this place is, there's order in this hierarchy.
Oh, yeah.
Right? There are set people at certain places that make sure that things go orderly. I mean, hell, you even see it when Gabe goes for the money, you know, when he's asking for the 600. Right? It's like they mark that shit. They keep it. In fact, Gabe, he gives the 600, right? But he takes it right back. You know, it's like, oh, well, we're going to hold it for you in vouchers because you're going to get arrested. Right? So it's not like he's even giving the money away. He's just using that to convince the two boys to stab them or to allow one of the boys to stab and the other one to take the blame for it.
Yeah.
Right? So again, that's the kind of geography that I find very fascinating about how this film deals with it. We see the outside. We kind of see where the gate is. We kind of see where the office is. And kind of we see the hierarchy because we see the different levels. Gabe is kind of a middleman. You know, he has a boss that he answers to. And, of course, his boss has a boss that we'll find later on. You know, there's people underneath. There's order in these ranks. And that's very important for when the shit goes down, because we know that they are ready and prepared for a situation like this, and that our four protagonists, and it'll eventually turn to six at one point, but they are up against a force that they more than likely are not going to come out alive, right? But what do you think about the fact that our protagonists, who are definitely not of the alt-right persuasion, decides as their first number to
fuck Nazis, yeah,
to bring out the dead Kennedys? That is kind of I was curious as to how the audience was going to respond to Nazi punks.
I was hoping some of them would go, well, this is a clever, ironic twist. Good job, guys. No, it's like, wait, what song is this?
I have a feeling that they've heard that song before.
Yeah.
But I also love the fact that most of them kind of are like, you know, they don't know what to make of it. You know, it's like, you know. These guys just have balls to come in here, call us Nazi punks, and that, you know, we should go fuck ourselves. And then, of course, they get into their real set, right? Because they have to get paid. But I also love the little joke that Sam gives Pat. It's like, if you think out on this now, I'm telling all of them you're Jewish.
Yeah.
Like, I love how it's done, kind not as a like a big joke. It's just she throws it out there, but it's funny. But at the same time, you know, it's not played for a laugh. It's just kind of a means of getting us, you know, kind of setting the tone for the set, right? Right.
Yeah. Even though I was wondering, is he Jewish? But
I don't think it really matters.
Yeah, at that point, yeah.
But I also love the fact that when we get into the green room before the set, you know, they establish the cell phone that's in that's in the room. They set up the kind of the green room, kind of give us a small hint. We don't actually really spend time in the green room just yet, but we know that there's a green room. They know that the cell phone is there. So when Sam goes back for her cell phone, and of course they find the body,
yeah,
that kicks off for what we're going to get for the rest of the film, right?
And it does tell you always knock before going into a green room. So,
well, you know, you expect people to be fucking in a green room. You don't expect them to be killing each other
dead
in a green room.
Yeah.
But I love the fact that, you know, even when we see the body, we kind of see it, but it's kind of played pretty quickly. So it's not like it's harboring on the fact that there's a dead body, but there is one, and we know that something is about to happen, but it jumps straight into kind of the chaos right away. So we don't really get a really good glimpse of the dead body until later when they're stuck in the green room, right?
Right.
But what do you make about the chaos that occurs after the revelation? Because that's something that I find very, very interesting the first time I saw it. You know, the fact that, you know, everyone's trying to control the situation. You know, you have Gabe that's kind of doing one thing. You have Big Justin, who is, you know, he goes and grabs the gun, right? You have Worm, who's also trying to control things. Right, there's a whole bunch of people, and that, you know, and throughout all this, it's cut really quickly. Did y'all kind of catch all the things that were going on, all the people that were kind of in the scene?
There was just so much going on. A couple people, between the people freaking out and the people trying to maintain control and failing, so it's like, why could they? Because who walked away from the door? That was Big Justin, right?
Yeah, Big Justin.
They're supposed to be watching. Yeah, he was supposed to be keeping people out, and yeah.
Yeah. I love the throwaway line. It's like, well, you were right there. It's like, yeah, until I wasn't.
Yeah.
and part of it was Gabe. The question I had going into this was, who knew about the dead body prior to them? Because you saw that they were kind of trying to keep them out of the green room, right? They had their stuff packed up right in front of the door. They just forgot the cell phone, right? Big Justin was going to lead them out and, you know, kind of set it at that. So we know that Big Justin knew. We knew that Worm knew because he was inside. We know that Imogen Poots knew, Amber knew, because, you know, she was in the room with the dead body. And do we know if Gabe knew?
I don't think so. You know, I don't think Gabe knew, because they tell Gabe, don't they tell Gabe who died?
Yeah, you're right.
Later? Yeah, because he didn't know,
So, and I think it's interesting because he's the one that gets the blunt of the blame for all of this going tits up, and he had absolutely no idea. And it wasn't as though, you know, someone was telling him, oh, we're going to murder this chick in the green room. In fact, it seemed like it was kind of, as we find out later on, it was kind of a in the heat of the moment kind of situation, right?
Yeah.
But did watching it and getting into this particular scene, did you have any idea as to what was going on? Did you have any have a hard time following all the chaos?
It's
What about you, Chris?
You know,
I mean, I'm not sure I followed, even on a second viewing, I'm not sure I followed every specific thing that was going on. All you could tell was they're scrambling to try to cover this up while, you know, the band's in the fucking room freaking out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty much all you need to know. I mean, you can see the extent they're going to, trying to keep this thing afloat, you know. But, yeah.
So, what did you take about when they're saying, okay, well, we're just trying to figure things out. Let's go back. You know, we're going to put you back in the green room, and we're going to get this all sorted out. Did you believe them? Or did you that something bad was about to happen?
As soon as they got thrown back in that green room, you're like, they're going to die.
Yeah.
That was pretty much my reaction as soon as I saw it. So
yeah.
Because if you're calling the cops for real, you want everybody out of that room.
Yeah.
Well, this is a neo-Nazi bar, so you know, I get the sense that they would want to make sure that, and especially considering that this is a very seedy bar, so God knows what other things are happening. It's not like you just want to have the cops called without, you know, making sure that all the secrets haven't been, you know, taken care of.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
I mean, you as the bar, you have two options: kill them or bribe them. And whereas they don't quite have the money to bribe them, so.
One thing that I absolutely love about this movie is the fact that the movie sets up extremely good reasons why these four shouldn't be murdered right away. Right. And they go exhaustively making it very clear why they're not killing them immediately. And this is the only time where the film feels like it has to explain to the audience why they're not being murdered straight off the bat. Right. Because it's going, because well, especially when they call in Darcy, you know, to kind of set up the, to handle the situation. Darcy, in a way, is kind of going to be a bit of our explanation, right? He's going to be giving the explanation, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, he's going to come up with the plan to cover up.
Yeah, and what do you think about how efficiently, you know, they're working to meet that, because they effectively sequester the band, you know, Pat had already called had already called 911, but they also knew that when Pat called, he called about a stabbing. He didn't say that someone was dead. He just said someone was stabbed because he didn't see it. Sam did. He was just going off of what Sam said. And she said there was someone that was stabbed with a knife.
Stabbed.
So he calls 911. They know that he said a stabbing. So what they do, they get two true believers. I love that they use kind of little inside, you know, inside lingo. We'll find out what true believers is in just a moment.
Yeah.
But, you know, we see them being bribed to, you know, to have one stab the other so that they can cover that 911 call, right?
Be the victim. Make sure the guy you stabbed doesn't die, and he'll get taken to the hospital.
Oh, no, no, not just that he doesn't die, but the fact that he uses a blade that's like 1 inch short from being felony possession.
Right.
That is, I mean, again, this is the exhibition that we're going to be getting, just so that we know kind of how efficient that they are. A movie that didn't give any exposition prior to this is now giving us exhibition. But the thing is the reason it's doing that is because if we didn't get that information, we would be getting a whole different idea of what's happening, right? Because then we would be complaining, well, why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? Why didn't they, you know, why is it that these two kids were willing to stab each other? The movie makes sure that we understand kind of what those stakes are, so that when we get to the decisions that we get later in the film, we understand why we get those decisions, or at least on the neo-Nazi side, right?
Right, right.
But it also, I guess in a way, it kind of gets us to what I think the film is kind of talking about, which I want to say is order versus chaos. The neo-Nazis are ordered. You know, they have a hierarchy. They have a rank. They work together as a unit. This is exemplified with what, you know, Pat's talk about the paintball game, right?
Right.
And the band, the punk rockers, are chaos. They do not work together. They don't organize as a group. They are out for each, you know, for themselves. They, you know, they make horrible decisions and they die off pretty quickly.
Quickly.
Are y'all kind of getting that?
Well, they don't. Most of the ones that die off don't think through their actions before they get killed. But...
Well, none of them think throughout their actions.
Yeah.
Even Pat. I mean, Pat should have known not to stick his hand out into that door jam. He should have known, you know, that if he was going to throw the gun out, even if he took the bullets, they would have had fucking bullets for the gun. That would have done nothing.
Or their own guns already. And...
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the thing is that they make, it's not like they make completely stupid decisions, but they make panicked decisions, right?
Right. They should have given them the bullets and kept the gun. So,
I don't know. The thing is, I guess this is where I'm going to start asking the question, would you have done any differently? And if you had, without hindsight, without knowing what is going to happen next, would you have made a different decision than the one that they made?
Oh, there's a lot of decisions in there.
That's true. And so, I'll tell you, after I watched the movie for the first time, I asked myself these exact questions. And the answer that I had to honestly say to myself was, I don't know if I would have made a different decision. If I were in that same situation, under the panic, in fact, I'd probably say I would have even waited as they told me to, and I would have been killed like 5 minutes into the movie.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I don't know how I would have responded. But then again, I wouldn't have taken a gig at a neo-Nazi bar either.
Yeah. And then there's also, you know, knocking on the green room door before you just barge in to go, hey, I forgot my cell phone.
There's no reason for them to think that there was anyone in there. I mean, yeah, they had the headliner that was coming in, but we didn't know if they were actually in the green room or not.
I thought they thought there was another band warming up there, so.
Well, he said the headliner was in there, but
yeah. Okay, well, if that's the case, then yeah, she probably should have knocked. But again, that's why all their stuff was rockers, out. Not exactly, you know, the harbingers of good being polite.
Yeah.
So, just saying. Fucking punk rockers. Yep.
Punk rockers would do that to other punk rockers. So just go, hey, just making sure you're not doing anything.
Yes. The gentle, sweet punk rock band who plays at neo-Nazi bars.
It's honor between the bands, so, you know. It's about the music, man. Respecting the other person's instruments, man. Okay.
Well, I mean, the Cattle Guard band, you know, the moment that I knew that they were dead, that there was no coming back, was when Worm basically said, yeah, I killed her to that song that I liked. Like, as soon as he admitted to killing the girl, was like, oh, there's no way they're coming out of this alive.
Yeah.
And if you notice, that's exactly when Pat realized that there was no, that they weren't coming out of that alive. You know, it was on his face like, oh, shit, we're in trouble. But, so, at this particular point, we get some heavy, brutal violence. Yeah. What did you think about the violence that we got in this movie? Let me put it this way. Wait. Are you going to have a hard time sleeping at night?
No. Going to have a hard time with some people on Facebook that post questionable content that, you know, Worm might appreciate. But, I will say that, you know, for small budget movies have more ability to more graphic effects in than they did in the earlier days. So
it's prosthetics, man.
This is the same type of shit that we would see in Killer Clowns and in the Friday the 13th. In fact, I want to say it's basically the same prosthetics that Friday the 13th had.
Well, there's a lot more gun shooting and bone. Well. Dislocation.
All right, so I have to admit, when Pat's arm comes out, Pat's arm is fucked up, and
yeah.
Oh, that thing is gone.
When I saw the film for the first time, and you see the extent of how it was pretty much chopped off, Pat's arm was in the theater. I squealed that. I just didn't expect it. Again, we don't see that kind of violence before. And, you know, I thought, well, yeah, he's going to get hurt. And, you know, there's going to be a little bit of violence. I didn't expect to see his arm basically drooping from his freaking skin.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to give it to Anton Yelchin, how he screamed in that scene. That scream is definitely the kind of scream that you would have if your hand was getting hacked off. Right. And the response to seeing his hand pretty much hacked off also is warranted for what you were seeing, right? I mean, if you've seen your arm like that, you'd probably be feeling the same way, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But again, I don't even know if that's the most brutal thing that happens in this movie. I mean...
Who's at the bar that gets shot?
Oh, that was Daniel.
That was Daniel. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
I also love how that reveal is, well, no one knows where the...
Yeah.
Like, too late. How quick. I mean, and they set that up perfectly because it was fucking Darcy that says, what are we missing here? And we saw this scene of the shotgun the first time that they ventured out of the ventured out of the green room, and they got attacked at the in the staging area, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I also love how they set up the thing with the microphone, because that was pretty brilliant how they set that up. You know, and she's being attacked by the dog, and we'll talk about the dog in a second. And yeah, as she's attacking it, the microphone hits that amp, and you get that really nasty sound, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it worked. Right. I mean, it got the dog off.
Right.
All right, so let's go ahead and let's talk about the dog, or the dogs, because if I'm not correct, there's two that we see, right? So, I mean, we've never really seen dog violence like this before. I mean, we've seen dogs be used to take people down, but we've never seen, in graphic detail, a dog basically chew a guy's throat out.
Good effects. I gotta applaud that.
Yep.
So that's, and I gotta say, I had very mixed feelings about the dogs, because, you know, mm-hmm, I've got my own cute puppy Whoopi, and, you know, dogs are adorable, and it's like, how this movie ends, you're like, poor doggy, even though he killed a couple of the main characters, I should not like him, but aww, I feel so bad for him.
The dog was trained to be the killer.
I know, it was trained, it had a command word, so, which is kind of how I knew at the very end it wasn't going to do anything, because nobody was giving it any commands.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was operating on, oh no, where's Master at? So... Yeah.
But it was, yeah. I mean, it was fucking brutal to see that dog, you know, tear apart that, I want to say it was, was Reese that that got his throat torn out?
I thought it was Sam.
No,
Sam
got the dog too, but that was later.
Yeah.
Tiger was the one that had his throat chewed out.
Okay, so
and then Reese was the one that made it out the window, and then he got fucked up outside.
Yeah, he got stabbed. Over and over again. And the scene that to me showed Darcy's kind of brilliance is, like, let him bleed. It'll do best for the time of death. It's like, he's already thinking, like, five steps ahead as to what he's going to do with these bodies. Right? It's like, to me, that's... All right, we have to talk about it. We have to talk about Darcy, all right? Kent... What were you thinking when you saw Patrick Stewart show up as the head white supremacist?
What was that phrase? Acting! So,
what is he acting, though?
He is... Well,
I mean,
yeah,
he was obviously acting, but what I mean is you say acting as though, you know, he's being great Shakespearean, but he doesn't really do that. He's kind of quiet. You know,
he's being in charge, almost a captain of things, just coordinating and being the man with the plan, and kind of getting this impression he's done stuff like this before. Maybe not exactly this exact scenario, but stuff like this has happened, either where he was in charge or he worked under somebody else that coordinated something similar to this, and he's already plotting... Okay, how do we're just missing one thing, and we could hide all the bodies and cover it up perfectly. What are we missing? And he finds the siphon and goes, bingo, accident.
Well, it wasn't the siphon that gave him the key. It was the baseball bat. It was the bat that was supposed
was
supposed to have been destroyed after Easter, but it wasn't.
Yeah.
And that was when he got his brilliant idea. He decided to use the siphon because that was in the van.
Yeah. I thought his original plan was burn the bodies in some siphon.
No, he can't
accident.
Burn the bodies. They have to be found. But the whole idea was that... All right, so the plan itself was meant to be that he kind of calls it out when they're in the green room. You know, they came into his establishment. They brought a gun.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, they were attacking his people, and they are... Still, you know, that they are, and they were kind of locked up in his green room, and that that they were so violent that they had to take care of them. But the thing was, is that they couldn't make it look like they were murdered, but that they had been attacked. right? Or, you know, that they've been driven off and they've been attacked and they had died of their injuries. You know, again, something they could say self-defense, right?
Right.
So, and of course, after they find the bat, then they decide to take it that, you know, that they were stealing gas and they were attacked, you know, they were caught, you know, and
so they attacked. The bat, I get the feeling it was originally used on another murder.
They call it out.
And somebody was supposed to dispose of it, and they didn't.
No, they said it again. It was Worm. Worm was supposed to destroy it, and he didn't.
Oh, Worm was supposed to? Okay, I wasn't sure if it was Worm or the girl that was murdered was supposed to get rid of it.
No, the girl wasn't.
Okay,
so there's two things that are happening. There's the plot, the cover up for the murder of these kids and the murder of the original girl. So the girl was Worm's. Worm and this girl were an item. She was going to run off with someone. Now, it was kind of implied that it was Daniel that she was going to run off with, but it was probably someone else from what it sounds like. And that they were going to use tonight, the night of this kind of lineup to do it. And of course, Warren found out, and he murders his girlfriend, right?
Okay.
So that's kind of the thing that set this whole thing off. Warren was already a made guy with this group, so they weren't going to take care of him. They'll just help him, you know, cover this up and bada bing. Unfortunately, the band prior to Cattle Guard came in and saw, or, you know, one of the band members saw it, and she made a big fuss. The problem is because their presence in this bar had already been made because of people on social media. You know, all the people that were in the club had gotten on Facebook and was saying, oh, you know, this band, and they, you know, posted photos.
This band rocks.
So they can't just make him disappear. Because, you know, this would be the last place that these people had been seen, and then of course it would bring the cops. And as we find out, they're making heroin in this establishment.
Is it heroin or
No, they called it heroin.
They did say heroin. Okay.
And apparently, as it turns out, the people, considering what Darcy says, it apparently that the skinheads were selling it to the African American community. And apparently they, or at least Darcy feels bad for, you know, giving this poison to African Americans. If anything, just because it requires that they make contact with African Americans. Which, stand-up guy, this Darcy.
Can't he at least look at it as taking their money and killing them?
Well, no, because...
willingly.
You know, I mean, why just get a few bucks from them now when you could just have them coming back and giving you more money? Now, kind of like the tobacco industry.
Ooh.
I said it.
Yeah. Please address your emails to...
I doubt anyone's going to say that I'm wrong in this one, but...
You'd be surprised.
I'll take that. I'll take it. But what do we take about, you know, kind of the fact that, in a way... the plan that they initially kind of had started would have been the one that probably got them out without losing anyone. Because as we see later on, they had the right idea, right? Basically lure them in, get their weapons, and take them out, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the only problem was is that they didn't work together. They basically kind of went in their own way and got picked off. I mean, am I wrong here?
It's a weird situation because they're basically in a bunker under siege, mm-hmm. but they want out, mm-hmm. and they can't get out. And you know, none of them think about Molotov cocktails. You got all the ingredients right there. Alcohol-based ones, not gasoline.
But every time that they step out of that green room, they get attacked. You know, it's not like they've had a chance where they could have, and especially considering that when they get the shotgun, even I'm thinking, okay, well, you have just leveled the playing field, you know, with that shotgun and the amount of shells that they have. And I love the fact that they even kind of make sure that we realize everyone has some shotgun shells so that we can keep count of all the shots, right?
Yeah.
But, I mean, the efficiency of this scenario and the fact that they're under... There's really very little chance of them getting out of this alive, right? I think that's the thing that really brings the tension and the terror aspect to this film, right?
It's... Yeah, there's no way to surrender. There's no way to get out safely.
And every possible way they can get out, we've seen how that fails. You know, they go through the front, they get mauled. They go through a window, they get mauled. They try to sneak out, they get attacked. It's, you know, they constantly put the pressure. Hell, they have an insider. Daniel, after he sees what happens to his secret girlfriend, joins their side, and as soon as he does, he gets a shotgun to the face.
Yep.
And that looked nasty.
Yeah.
That was the one where it's like, it was after the surprise, I wanted to go, congratulations. That was amazing. I mean, the way that his face just fucking falls off with that shot. I mean, damn. Like, if they did that with physical effects, I don't know how they did it. Like, that was...
They actually killed him. No. Mark Webber is dead. No.
Tell me about it. But,
has he been in anything since? Oh, wait, never mind. He has.
Yes,
so.
He has.
He's been in quite a bit.
We'll be
getting
into the geek sheet in just a little bit. We'll discuss that. But I guess the thing is that when they eventually get to the plan that works, what did you take of the... considering that we have the paintball... the paintball story that kind of gives us an indication of what they should do, and that the fact that well, it doesn't outright say exactly how they're going to do it. It does kind of give you the groundwork for it, right?
Yeah.
And
all it takes to mess up a well-ordered plan is something they're not expecting, and they're not expecting a lot.
Well, in a way, I wonder. And maybe it's just me, but do you get the idea that perhaps the fact that this was an all-night siege and the fact that these people probably didn't start the night fully rested to begin with might have played a part in the fact that they kind of let their guard down a little bit? I mean, hell, Gabe is, like, putting on an apron and, like, cleaning up the place, you know, thinking that this is pretty much all set and done, right? And what do you think about him being basically the only one to walk out, the only neo-Nazi to walk out? What do you think?
Kind of had mixed feelings on that, because he is Nazi, but at the same time he's like, wait, we've gone over the line. No, stop.
No, he didn't.
Because I kind of thought he had something going with the dead girl at first, but since he switched sides like that.
No, it's because they had guns, he didn't. You got the point. It's like, I'll do whatever you want. Just don't shoot me.
Okay.
And he's the only one who doesn't do anything violent. I mean, you know, he...
Yeah.
He's the one that's trying to manage this. In fact, I leave it to... If he could have found a non-violent way to get them out of there, he probably would have. Yet at the same time, I also find it very interesting. He also gets his red shoelaces off of this.
Before cleaning up, right?
Yeah, he gets his shoelaces and then he gets to cleaning up. It's like, well, you earned this because of your action. Now, do you know what red shoelaces mean in the neo-Nazi circles?
Some sort of rank indicator.
It is a rank. Also, it's also very interesting that throughout the film, they do kind of mention only red shoelaces are the ones that will be a part of this. The reason being is because red shoelaces in neo-Nazi terms is an indicator that you have been involved in something violent on the behalf of the organization. It's basically kind of the neo-Nazi version of bicycle gang leathers. You earn those, and it's an indication to the group that you are that you're one of the hardcore. In fact, it's known that neo-Nazi skinheads will attack non-white people simply so they can get their red shoelaces. Just a little FYI for all you enthusiasts of really twisted history.
Shoes.
I doubt footwear has anything to do with this.
Well, it's an indicator not to buy Red's shoelaces just because, hey, those are pretty. If you might get confused for something you're not.
Well, that depends on if where you are. His heavy neo-Nazi kind of a background. So, like that. But what do we think about kind of the final confrontation between Pat and, you know, between Pat and Darcy? What do we take of this scene?
You know, part of me wanted to yell, it's that fanfic of Chekhov going after Picard. We've always wanted.
Do we really want Chekhov to be the one that puts it into Picard? I will say one thing, that after this movie, William Shatner is like all pissed off because not even in his fanfic would he kill Picard. But I will say one thing when it comes to the death of Darcy. I love the fact that he takes a bullet to the chrome dome. It's like, yeah, that his head, you know, his bald head has been so iconic. The fact that he takes a bullet to it just feels right. I don't know.
Like, what should have happened to Professor Xavier movies ago?
Well, have we ever seen, you know, Patrick Stewart take one to the head?
Have we ever seen him?
Not that I know.
Well, I was going to say, have we even seen him die? But wait, he died in Dune, didn't he?
No, he didn't die in Dune. But he did die in Conspiracy Theory. But if I'm not correct, he was drowned in Conspiracy Theory.
Okay.
I mean, he's obviously dead. He was killed in the third X-Men movie.
Yeah. Now, granted, there were a lot of headshots in this movie. Just saying that.
Well, not really a whole lot of headshots. No, in fact, it's actually more body parts were shot because Imogen Poots, Amber takes like a couple in her arms and legs.
Yeah.
If I'm not correct, the drummer takes a shot before he gets stabbed. No, I mean, in fact, one thing that I got to grant this movie is when it comes to bullets, they actually, for the most part, even like with Patrick Stewart's headshot, it actually like bounces off his skull. It breaks it because you see the blood spurting out of his head, but it's not like it's planted into his skull, right?
Hmm.
I mean, just look at how it's shot. It's shot off to the side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I love about what gun violence is in this movie. It's not clean. It's not video gaming.
No.
It's not not one shot, one kill, right?
Right.
I think the only one that really gets the cleanest death is the dog guy, because he takes a shotgun basically to the stomach. But that's not even just one bullet, though. That's, you know, it's a shot. It's a spread.
Yeah, scatter shot. Well, it's one cartridge. Yes.
Well, it's also point blank range.
Yeah.
But. I also love the fact that when it comes to death, maiming, well, you'll see it in Glorious, you know, with Glorious long shots, but death is really sudden and quick. And that's something that I really appreciate about what this film does. It doesn't glorify death. And in a way, the violence is meant to make you feel disgusted. It's meant to give you the sense that this is nasty business, right? And this is something that actually comes from Blue Ruin. Blue Ruin does the same thing as well, and I really appreciate how these films deal with violence and death specifically. But Green Room definitely is the more violent of the two films, though. Way more violent. But I guess what that leaves us with is, what did you think about the finale? What did you think about all the carnage and where it leads up to? Does this all tie in together? Does this feel like it comes to a natural spot, or does it feel like it's just violent, or, you know, or the carnage is basically just meant to be a spectacle?
It's about the only way they were going to get out of there, kill everything in their path, and
yeah. But does it feel like that, like the film earns that violence, or does it just feel gratuitous?
Well, I wouldn't say gratuitous, because we've been working towards a point of something like this. It's not just happening. we have explanations.
I mean, in addition to it being a means of escape, isn't it also like retribution for who they lost over the course of the past day or whatever?
Well, it's not even the past day. It's like within like 24 hours.
It's not even that. It's like, it feels like 6 hours or something ridiculous.
Well, if it started off at,
I mean, they do say it's nighttime.
It starts around dawn.
Yeah, well, so it went, 14, 15 hours, depending on time of year, so.
Also, did you find it interesting that after Darcy is killed, that's when the sun comes out?
Yeah. Irony.
It's not even like one of those things where like everything just gets brighter. It's just that you see on the trees that there's sunlight breaking through. It's done very casually. But
yay, victory over skinheads. The sun can come out now.
But there's only one more question I have to ask before we get into the finale. Okay. But what is, in fact, your desert island group? Your desert island band?
God. Oh, what band if I'm stuck on a desert island? Ooh. You know, coming to mind right away is Queen. Maybe it's just because there's enough of their music that I like and they just haven't done any real crappy stuff.
I don't know. I always thought that you were a Captain and Tennille fan myself. What about you, Chris?
I'm not sure. I'm going to pull a Pat. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think I might take a note from one of the survivors and tell someone who fucking cares. Or who fucking gives a shit. But now, one thing I do love is the interview that they give to the reporter. That's on the radio during the violent confrontation. It's in the van.
Oh.
I didn't catch it the first time. I only caught it on the second time that it was playing.
Isn't it playing afterwards, though, like when the dog's walking up?
Oh, yeah, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
So, and, of course, we do have to mention that I think both dogs survived. One of them was chained up and the other one wasn't chained. But I also love the fact that when the dog comes by, they do try to shoot it, but they're out of bullets.
Yeah.
But what do you think was the fate of that dog that laid his head on his former master? Do you think it just basically died of sadness?
That or animal control put it down later on, just in case. Because if cops come out and they give the full story and the dog's sitting there, they'd be like,
put down.
Oh yeah, and she died because that dog tore her throat out. And the dog's just sitting there like, it would have been put down. Yeah. So unfortunately, I mean, it's not its fault, but I don't think there's way to really deprogram them and just for safety they do that.
No, they won't.
Just to make sure that nobody accidentally says that keyword around him.
That's true, because you never know who speaks German.
Yeah, well, yeah. So
such a sneaky language. Yeah.
Yes.
Could come up at any point. I mean, that's, when I fought this, I mean, an Amish family could walk by. I don't know. Because what was the command word?
False.
That sounds, yeah, some false. Did you floss today? You mean floss?
I don't know. I think it also has to be done with the force. So you have to say, floss!
Yeah.
You know, got to give it some oomph behind it. But before we...
Still before, too dangerous.
One
last
thing. Obviously, we're talking about the last film that was released before Anton Yelchin's passing away. How did that affect your opinion of this film? Chris, you'd seen it before his passing, like I had. Coming back to this movie, did it change your opinion of the film? Did you perhaps see something more or something less from the film on the second viewing?
I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, the first thing I remember seeing him in is Charlie Bartlett, and like I've liked him ever since. And like his passing just made me appreciate his acting more. When I went to Fantastic Fest, the first movie I saw was Thoroughbreds, which is his last movie. So, I mean, he was the best part of the movie. So, like, I don't know, I just enjoyed him to another extent, I guess. It just makes you wish you were still here, you know?
What about you, Kim?
There were points in this look in this film where I was like just trying not to be halfway crying because he's not around anymore. So it's like, no, gotta focus on what's going on in the movie, and ooh, that was a gruesome incident. Okay. But yeah, it's just...
Well, I should say that in 2000, a movie came out based on a Stephen King novel called Hearts in Atlantis. Starred Anthony Hopkins and Hope Davis, and the little boy that was basically the perspective character, which was Anton Yelchin. Since then, I was so impressed with his performance. And you have to understand, you know, he was basically going toe-to-toe with Sir Anthony Hopkins, you know, Hannibal Lecter himself.
Yeah.
And he was so impressive in that that I kind of kept my ear to the ground on the things that he was doing afterwards. And most of the stuff during his teen years really wasn't a whole lot. You know, nothing of real note until Charlie Bartlett. And he was given basically the lead role. At some point, I would love to talk about Charlie Bartlett. In my opinion, it was the 2000s version of Catcher in the Rye. In my opinion, it's on the same level as that, and also of another film by Wes Anderson called Rushmore, which I absolutely love. But Yelchin was an actor who he was willing to take on roles and take on challenges that showed a kind of skill that you don't really see with young actors. And I was always loving seeing him go forward and try different things and to take on new roles. And I love the fact that he was willing to do things differently. You know, I hated Terminator Salvation, but I really enjoyed seeing him take on the Kyle Reese character. I loved what he did with Star Trek. I loved what he did with Fright Night, which we've kind of talked about a little bit, you know, that Imogen Poots had done first, and it's one of the few remakes I will say is even better than the original. I was a huge fan. You know, when Green Room came out, as much as I'm a Jeremy Saulnier fan, I was excited to see Anton Yelchin in this movie. I was excited to see what he would do next. And when he died, because I had been following him since he was young, that kind of hit me a little bit. Not as much as other actors. Bill Paxton definitely is the harder one of the two that have passed this year. But it definitely left an impact. And it's one of those times when I feel very deeply for the loved ones. And the fact that he left behind a group of people, friends and family, collaborators, people who truly couldn't say enough good things about him. And the fact that he died of such a ridiculous accident. I mean, not from drugs, not from natural causes, just something stupid. You know, something that could have happened to anybody. You know, I think that's the thing that really kind of makes that more difficult. But at the same time, though, he left a body of work that any actor should be proud of. And is one of those that will have a lasting... You know, we'll leave a lasting memory of anyone who's seen his work. And for Green Room specifically, he was a very strong reason that I enjoyed the film when I saw it. And I'll set my hand here that I still love it as much as I do. But before we get into that, Kent, why don't you run us down with the geek sheet?
Well, we've already gone over the fact that Anton Yelchin has... made us love Chekhov again. Well, okay, we loved him before, but and also was a big part of the Fright Night remake that seems to be one of the best remakes of all time, according to some people. So he's been quite a few geeky things. Let's see, Allie or Sam, as she played in here. Yep, we all watched Arrested Development, right?
Yep.
Everybody watched Arrested Development. Yep.
I'm sorry, but I love Maybe. Maybe's one of my favorite characters.
Yeah. Isn't she? Let's see. Of course, Patrick Stewart we'll just say duh and move
well,
on.
Basically, you're just wanting him to tell his neo-Nazis to just make it so, weren't you?
That would have been interesting, but I think he intentionally tried not to say anything any of his upper parts would say, ever.
Actually, there's a fun story about how he became a part of this movie, but that's one of those things you'll have to find out later, but I'll tell you after we're done recording.
I was wondering how he got...
it's a great story. It's great.
Jeremy Saulnier got some of these people, so... Oh, let's see. Where the hell was I? Did I cover Callum Turner? No, I didn't. Geek-wise, Callum Turner is going to be in the next Fantastic Beasts movie, so part of the Potterverse now.
Woo!
So, Star Trek and Potterverses collide! Let's see. Imogen Potts was in V for Vendetta and 28 Weeks Later and Need for Speed.
But don't forget what she was in V for Vendetta.
I have to admit, I haven't seen V for Vendetta yet. Shh. Okay. I'm going to go hide now.
we'll have to fix that, unfortunately. It might have to be next year because the 5th of November is definitely one that...
We've got stuff planned for the 5th of November for this year. Well,
true.
Early November. We know what we're doing for early November. Where were we? Didn't you have something to say about somebody else particularly?
We did talk about one individual that you haven't brought up just yet. The one who got the shotgun to the face, Mark Webber, in another kind of rock and roll movie.
Yes. He was a... Was he the world? No, he was just involved in the crossfire of Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
He was Stephen Seals. So,
the talent.
The man with the dream.
Yeah.
Yes, he was
the
talent. Yeah. Alright, so at this point... Let's go ahead and let's call it. Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Green Room? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Kent?
The only thing I have to caveat on is at times this seemed to be less art house of horror and more like a art house of incredible suspense.
Are we going to have the Silence of the Lambs argument again?
So we may, but I'll just push it aside and say, you know, it feels less horror, more suspense, but still a pass no matter what.
Chris.
So you could argue it, but yeah.
Chris.
I mean, it's a pass, obviously. I mean, I liked it a lot when I first saw it, but I feel like it actually gets better with each viewing. Cause, I mean, I liked it even more when I just watched it, so... I mean, it's super intense, and like the effects are amazing. It's just it's a fucking awesome movie. It's great. So yeah, it's a pass.
I've already kind of tipped my hat. I absolutely love this movie. It still holds up. This is a movie that I will definitely come back to when I'm in a Hitchcock vibe, and I've overwatched all my Hitchcock movies. It's got that level of suspense. I do find this to be a horror film, although it's a horror film on the same level as, like, say, The Purge or other kind of action-oriented horror films. That said, though, the violence is intense. The suspense is on your seat. I remember in the theaters being on the edge of my seat during the last 40 minutes of the movie because I didn't know what was going to happen next. I didn't know what was on the other end of the door. You're constantly having your expectations wrecked over and over and over again to the point where you get to the finale and you're just wanting to take a breath. And to me, that's the great sign of a horror film. If it's capable of keeping you on edge and you just don't know what's going to happen next. And Green Room, Jeremy Saulnier has shown that he is capable of keeping that tension up, and he's capable of doing it in a horror vibe. Whereas, like, Blue Ruin is more of an action drama. This one is more more of a kick to the system, and I cannot wait to see what he does next. And whether it'll be next year or the year after, I really hope that he has something in store for us. I can't wait. Super big pass. Love this movie. And it's time for us to say goodbye to October. But not before we have a special Halloween episode, which we have every year. So keep your eyes open for that on October 31st. But what do we have coming up in November? Kent, what do we have coming up first?
First off, now it's sort of November of this year, where we're recording. There's a certain big budget movie coming out that's part of a big series of movies, but has a director who isn't quite as known to the general populace.
But he is well known. But
we know him.
Legends.
We know him. We love him because we covered him. Was that last October we covered him? Or was
that
2 years ago?
That was last year.
Yeah. For one of the movies I felt was one of the greatest of all time.
All I have to say is shame.
But he's...
Shame. Shame.
Shame. Shame. But he's done quite a few movies in his native country, and one of them being Hunt for the Wilder People is what we're going to be
doing.
Which
came out last year.
Right off. Right. That is just last year. Wow, I thought that movie was older than that. Okay, but that's right off the bat. That's the first one in November. What did we decide the second one? Was it the
nighttime
one, or was it the...
Well, let's just say that another filmmaker has his new movie coming out later this year, Paul Thomas Anderson. And we thought we would talk about him and,
That's right.
And a little porno.
Mom chicka wow wow. Boogie nights. Boogie those nights away. Yeah.
What else do we got?
I don't know. Rounding things off, there's actually five Wednesdays in November of 2017. So that means five episodes in November. So Hunt for the Wilder People, Boogie Nights, rounded off with the original version of The Italian Job, LA Confidential, and comic book movie Unbreakable.
There you go. So we got a little Shyamalan, we got a little Michael Caine, we got ourselves a little more Kevin Spacey.
See?
And that's just the name of the movies we're doing in November. And you don't want to miss out on what we got for December, but we're not going to talk about that just yet. So if you are interested in talking about this movie or any of the other movies that we've talked about earlier this month with Art House of Horror, you can do so on our Facebook page or hit us up on Twitter at Art House Legends or send us an email at arthouselegends@gmail.com. If you feel up to it, you can always go over to our iTunes page and give us a 5-star review. Help us circulate the episodes out to a newer crowd and get more people in on this awesome fun that we have going on here. And just get the word out as wherever you can. We would definitely appreciate it. But gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me for this amazing Art House of Horror season that we had this year. Any last words before we go?
Ooh, final words? Oh, you know, I almost opened this with a reading from my fanfiction where Chekhov finds the dead Ferengi in Picard's quarters and goes, "What's this?" But that would have been too much, right?
Shut up, Chekhov.
Right? Yeah.
All right.
Get back to your punk band.
Chris, any last words?
Nope. I got nothing.
Yeah.
For Art House of Horror, this is the Movie Dude Eric.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
Please leave us a positive review on iTunes.
Music by Kevin MacLeod.
Legends Podcast is not affiliated with any other entity. The opinions stated in this podcast are strictly personal and do not represent the view of its sponsor or any other person or entity. No infringement is intended.